Hey everyone, this is Steve Donahue with another episode of Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. Today's episode is number 38, and what we're going to do today is talk about 15 financial myths. And some of these myths you've probably heard about. If you have heard about them, I'm afraid probably you have bought into some of them. They are very common, and yet through my years as in the financial world, I have encountered this from client after client and from people after one another. Regarding these financial myths, sometimes we even read them in the regular papers, hear about them on the news, find out about them from advisors, whatever they might be. And they are myths that can be destructive to our legacy financially. And so I want to address those 15 financial myths. But before we do that, I want to direct you to some of the news and the updates. First of all, continue to look at us on our website, see the updates that are coming out there. Some of you may be looking only at the podcast. I do provide a couple of blogs here and there, so make sure you're checking out those blogs on the website as well. And make sure you're visiting some of our affiliates. Of course, right now, the only affiliate we have is 48 Days. 48 Days, of course, is the ministry or the work of Dan Miller. And in there, you can purchase a number of different items and material for helping you in business and employment. And particularly, there's a book in there called No More Mondays that will lay out how you can quit your job and start the business that you love. And so I encourage you to take a look at that. And then also, I would encourage you to give me some feedback. By the way, if you have not registered on the website, you can do that on the top right corner. That will allow you to leave some comments and give feedback on each of the episodes on the website, as well as allow you to be first to know about any new podcasts that come out or show notes or anything like that that might be on there. So I encourage you to register. No cost to that. And then give feedback if you would. You can do that on the right or left margin. There's a place for contact me. You can also do that through email at steve@thelegacypodcast.com. You can leave comments through each of the show notes. And then you can also provide comments through iTunes. And then I would encourage you to support the show if at all possible. And you can do that by liking us on Facebook and Twitter and sharing us on the various social media outlets. That way the word gets out about the Legacy Podcast. We're able to move up even further on Google searches and iTunes searches and all that kind of thing. And that, of course, all that does is it helps to build our community and help get the word out for people who are wanting to build a legacy. And then finally, consider becoming a legacy partner. That's our premium membership program, and that allows you to get access to our exclusive members only premium page. And in that, there's about $50 worth of value, including a debt-free program, including a grow chart, and then a 20% discount to Grow Veg online mapping software. All of those, of course, are beneficial to you, and you can have access to those for $30 a year or $3 a month. If you don't think that's valuable yet, that's okay. Hang in there, because it will be eventually. And as we continue to grow the community, I'll be able to get more sponsors, more people who are able to provide discounts for us, more additional ebooks, things like that, that will be able to benefit you. And so before long, you will certainly want to be a part of that. So consider the Legacy Partnership Program. So that takes care of the housekeeping for today. So let's go ahead and talk about the financial myths that are there. Number one is, and this, of course, was a myth more so prior to the last 4 or 5 years than it is now, but certainly still the same. And that is, number one, a house is a great investment because it always goes up in value. Now, I'm going to provide some notes or provide a chart in the show notes that shows the peak and valley recently in the housing market and how it shows that certainly that is not true. Now, there is called the Case-Shiller report that actually reports on the prices of homes throughout the nation. And recently, they came out with a new report saying that the gauge is down 35% from its peak before the housing bubble in 2006. And so house prices don't always go up, and they don't always stay static. They go up and down. And right now we are in a place where house prices have gone down. I don't think they've hit the bottom yet either. I think they're going to go down even further. I'm reminded of what Robert Kiyosaki said in Rich Dad, Poor Dad, where he says, a house is not an investment because it doesn't put money into your pocket in In fact, most of the time it takes money from your pocket. And so although it is an asset and it's certainly an asset class, it's not necessarily a good investment because an investment should put money back into your pocket, whereas a house ends up taking money out of your pocket. And so a house is not a great investment because it does not always go up in value. Number two is this is a risk-free investment. You've probably heard this by somebody trying to sell you an investment of some kind. They say, you know, this one's great because there's no risk involved and, you know, you'll be able to guarantee this and guarantee that. And, of course, there's very few guarantees in the world and investments is certainly not guaranteed. There's no such thing as a risk-free investment. There are all different kinds of risks that vary based upon the type of product that you have and the exposure that they have to these various risks. But none of them are totally without risk. And so I just want to cover some of those risks. Now, I'm going to do a whole new show or a whole complete show on the various investment risks, and I intend to do that here for too long. But here's just a list of some of them. The systematic or market risk. There's inflationary risk. There's credit or business risk, there's regulatory risk, and there's interest rate risk. And every investment, regardless of what the salesperson might tell you, has some exposure to one or more of these risks. And so it's just a matter of what risks you're willing to handle. Then number three is bonds are safer than stocks. Well, this relates, of course, to the risk-free investment above that I talked about on that question as to which one is safer and when. Well, it depends on what's going on in the environment, what's going on in the investment environment, what's going on, you know, around the world in the news and interest rates and all those kinds of things. You know, bond prices are inversely related to interest rates. And so, for example, they have a greater exposure to interest risk than do stocks. And so in a rising interest rate environment, now, of course, in the world that we live in right now, interest rates are artificially low because the Federal Reserve continues to buy our treasury notes. And as a result of that, they are continuing to force down the interest rates that should be quite a bit higher than they are right now. But nonetheless, they will go up. This situation of fake interest rates cannot continue forever, and so they will go up. And when, of course, they go up, the price of bonds go down. And so if you're holding bonds, that's a very risky proposition. And I would not be doing that right now. But again, you want to talk to a financial professional. A disclaimer here, I am not giving any kind of investment advice. But anyway, bonds are not always safer than stocks. Number four, you need life insurance your whole life. This you've probably heard from a life insurance salesperson who wants to sell you some kind of permanent product when it comes to life insurance. But in answer to that question, let me say this. Does Bill Gates need life insurance? What about Zuckerberg? Zuckerberg, of course, one of the co-founders there, main co-founder of Facebook. And, you know, with the new IPO and everything, he's worth multiple billions now. Does he need life insurance? I know he's just getting married here soon. And, you know, so he's going to start a family probably. And does he need life insurance? Well, no, he's got billions of dollars. You don't need life insurance when you've got all that kind of money. And so let me put it this way. If you had $10 million in liquid investments, would you need life insurance? No, I think your family would be just fine if you were to pass away financially. They would be just fine if you were to pass away at $10 million. And so you only need life insurance when you have no means of supporting dependents if you were to die. It's a way of transferring risk. And if you have the cash, then you don't need the insurance. If you don't have the cash, then you need the insurance to transfer the risk. Number six is term life insurance is like renting. It's throwing away your money. And so in answer to that question, let me say this. Then auto insurance and home insurance is doing the same thing because they're not building any kind of cash value either. It's only life insurance that builds cash value. You have to look at the actual beginnings of life insurance and how that came about and why they came up with this whole concept of cash value within the life insurance to begin with. Originally, it was term insurance, and then they wanted to be able to be like banks and make money off other people's money, and so they started this cash value program. And as a result of that, that's typically what is sold by most people today, but it's a horrible product, and it's not throwing away your money to get term insurance. It's actually the best thing you can do with your money for the value that you're getting. The whole purpose in insurance is not to use it, but to actually have it in case of emergency, and that's what term life does. Living benefits are available on riders now, as well as on term life insurance, as well as on cash value insurance. And so if you have to have an insurance program that has current benefits, you can actually get a living benefits rider onto your life insurance. But that's not necessary, and certainly it would in some ways defeat the purpose of life insurance. Number seven, buy and hold portfolios are the best investment strategies. Well, tell persons who have had a good balanced portfolio that in 2008 when every major asset class lost money. And so a buy and hold strategy works well when the markets are going up, but when the markets are going down, that hold strategy doesn't work so good. And so, you know, in the 1990s, when all the markets were pretty much going up and, you know, you could throw a dart at a mutual fund and make 10, 15%, those days are over. And what worked well then does not work well now. And yes, if you keep a mutual fund portfolio or portfolio stocks and bonds and you keep that for 30, 40 years, it's going to be worth more than what it was when you first bought it. But the question is, if you are nearing retirement and you only have 10 years left or 5 years left or something like that, is a buy and hold strategy really what you want? And, you know, there were probably some people in 2006 who had looked at their portfolio and said, you know what, I think I'll be able to retire in a couple years. And then 2008 came, and they lost 30% of their value because they had a hold strategy, buy and hold strategy, and it didn't work so well. And so you have to be able to have a program that can exit when the market's coming down and to re-enter when the market's going up. And so a buy and hold portfolio is not the best investment strategy. Number eight, if you dollar cost average, you don't need to worry about fluctuations in the market. First of all, let me explain dollar cost averaging real quick. Dollar cost averaging is the concept that if you purchase repeatedly over time, as the market goes up and down, when the market is down, you're going to be buying more shares than when the market is up. And so overall, you're going to be buying more shares low priced than you are higher priced. And this works fine and dandy when the purchases amounts are a significant portion of the overall value of the account that you are buying into. But when, so let's say you're buying $100 a month worth of some kind of stock or mutual fund or whatever it is, and you're dollar cost averaging that, but you only have $1,000 in the account to begin with. Well, that's a pretty significant amount. So if the market goes down 10%, you're able to buy, you know, 10% more shares with that $100. And, you know, your $1,000 went down $900. You can still make that up, and it's not a bad program. But if you've got $10,000 in your account and you're buying $100 a month and you lose 10%, you've now lost $1,000. There's no way that the benefit of buying more shares with that $100 is going to offset the loss that accounted in that regular account. And so dollar cost averaging is good to an extent, but it certainly does not mitigate the entirety of the fluctuations in the market. And so, yes, you still need to be concerned about the fluctuations. And, you know, there's a lot of people who say, don't worry about the everyday prices. I would say the same thing. Don't worry about the everyday prices, but you still need to worry about the fluctuations in the market and be ready to get out if the bottom is coming and be ready to buy if it's starting to go up. Number nine, if I had $1 million, I'd be set for life. You've probably heard that before. Someone would say, man, if I just had $1 million, I'd have everything. I'd be all squared away for the rest of my life. Well, maybe. You know, you should really only count on about 4 to 6% real return on your investment portfolio. Real return means after inflation. So, you know, despite the numbers of the federal government that says the inflation rate's about 2%, it's really more like 6 to 7%. And so if you have a 6 to 7% return and you get a 6% or a 6 or 7% inflation rate and you get a 6 or 7% return off of that, then you have to have a 12 or 13%, 14% return overall. And so, you know, what are the chances of that? Well, it's very slim. And so a 4% to 5%, 6%, that's really the max you can count on in order to be able to maintain your purchasing power and be able to maintain the value in the account. And so let's suppose that in today's dollars, then you had $1 million and you invested that. And that would pull off then about $40,000 to $60,000 of annual income. Is that enough? Is that really making you set for life? Well, then you add on to it maybe purchasing or, you know, paying off the rest of your debt, paying off the rest of your home, saving a little bit for the kids' college, these kinds of things. Now you're down to $800,000, $750,000, whatever it might be. And now you're down to $30,000 or $40,000 of income. It's certainly not the kind of money that we think about. We think $1 million, that's just every amount of money in the world. Not really. It goes a long ways. And so most people aren't saving nearly enough. And so $1 million would not get you set for life. Number 10, money isn't very important. Now, I find it interesting that the people that usually are saying this are the same people that really want more of it. or someone who doesn't have very much of it. And, you know, relative to health, relative to spiritual relationship with the Lord, relative to salvation, you're right, money is not very important. But it is very important for the things that it can do. In fact, I always find it interesting that, you know, churches could always use more money. Individuals could always use more money. Families could always use more money. Organizations could always use more money. Money is not the problem. In fact, money is a great thing. Money can be used for the good of many. Sometimes people can use it for bad, but that's not the problem with the money. It's the problem with the people. And so money is important because with money, you can build churches, you can build hospitals, you can do a lot of good things with it. You can start businesses, you can invest in capital, or, you know, you can provide capital investment, whatever it is. And so that those things are all beneficial. So money is very important. Number 11, gold is a good investment. I've also heard it said this way, and you might think it's contradictory, but I'll explain it here in a second. Gold is a lousy investment. Well, the problem with both of those statements and why both of them are myths is that gold is not an investment at all. In fact, what gold is gold is a hedge against inflation because gold is really a preservation of capital, is a preservation of money. It is money. And although some people think that what we carry around in our pockets with the Federal Reserve notes is money, that's actually a substitute for money. And the real money is actually gold and silver. It's been money for thousands of years. It will continue to be money for thousands of years. And so it's not really an investment. Rather, it's a store of value. It's a hedge against inflation. 1 ounce of gold can buy about an ounce of gold bought 100 years ago. I'm going to put a link in the show notes to this, but there's an article that explains the way in which money continues to be purchased, or that gold can still purchase about the same as it did at other periods in history. In 1979, gold's average price was $306. This bought an average-priced full-size bed. 30 years later, that same price of gold would buy a full-size bed, and so it maintained its purchasing power. In 1963, a gallon of gasoline in America sold for 31 cents. This meant that three silver dimes, of course, dimes back in before 1968, I believe it was, 67, or maybe it was 64. I forget. I have to look that up. But were silver. And silver and gold both were monetary metals. They can both be used as money and both be exchanged for money prior to this period. And so they served as money. It was not until after we came off the gold standard that that no longer reflected in our money. But it still reflects in life because of the purchasing power. And so this 3 cent dimes could buy a gallon of gasoline. And the total weight of a silver in three silver dimes is 0.217 of an ounce. And today, three silver dimes would buy a gallon of gasoline anywhere in the U.S. And then in 600 A.D. in the Middle East, a chicken at the time of Muhammad would cost a family one silver dirham. That's 3 grams. Today, 1,400 years later, a chicken in the Middle East would cost a family about one silver dirham. So it's maintained its purchasing power since 600 AD. Time of Christ, under the Roman Empire, an ounce of gold purchased a Roman citizen his toga, his suit, that is, a leather belt, and a pair of sandals. Today, 1 ounce of gold will still buy a man a suit, a leather belt, and a pair of shoes. So it's maintained its purchasing power since the time of Christ in the Roman Empire. In 400 BC, some scholars report that during the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar, an ounce of gold bought 350 loaves of bread. Today, an ounce of gold still buys about 350 loaves of bread. And so it's maintained its purchasing power since 400 BC. But get this, in 1000 BC, during the time of King Solomon, it was known to have purchased many horses for his army. You can read about that in the Bible. Historical records show that he bought them in Egypt for 150 shekels of silver each. 150 shekels was about 55 troy ounces of silver. And today, you can still buy a riding horse for 55 troy ounces of silver for about $800. And so it's maintained its purchasing power for thousands of years. And so it's not really an investment at all. Rather, it is money. It keeps its value and is able to purchase whatever it purchased hundreds of years ago. It can still purchase that same thing today, unlike the dollar that goes down in value. And so you have investments that go up in value. You have gold that maintains its value. And then you have dollars that go down in value. Number 12, all 10-year periods in the stock market have made money. You've probably heard this said before if you've listened to Dave Ramsey at all. He's mentioned this on a number of occasions, and what he's doing is referring to an Ibbotson research that occurred and has, you know, he's actually got a link to that in one of his online Total Money Makeover pages, and I'll put a link in the show notes to it, but it talks about the Ibbotson report and the research that is done there, and this is what they say. They say 97% of the 5-year periods and 100% of the 10-year periods in the stock market history have made money. Well, not so fast. From 1906 to 1924, that's an 18-year period, there was a negative 4.29% cumulative return. So for 18 years, in 1906, if someone would have bought a stock in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, something like that, would have bought into that in 1906, 18 years later, they would have not had any money more. In fact, they would have lost money by 4%. And then from 1929 to 1953, a 25-year period, there was only a 1.69% cumulative return. So yes, there was a gain during that 25-year period, but so minuscule after 25 years. There's so small of a gain, it's hardly even worth considering. And in 1965, especially when you consider inflation, in 1965 to 1981, 17-year period, had a 0.83% cumulative return. And then if you look at 2001 to 2010, the 10-year period, depending upon what month you start with and what month you end on that 10-year period, the 10 years either is a positive 2.66 or a negative 2.28. And so, you know, other months are in between those, but that's the high and the low. And so, you know, basically it's break even. And so when we look at this, there are 10-year periods that have done really, really lousy. Now, is it true that all 10-year periods have made money? No, it's not true that all 10-year periods. It depends on which month you pick from and things like that. And certainly some of those periods that they say have made money have been so miserably small that they really cannot even be accounted. I just can't imagine for 25 years only getting a 2% return over the entire 25-year period. That's not 2% per year. That's 2% for the entire period. I mean, that's just pitiful. And so the 10-year periods in the stock market have not always been great. And we need to be able to have an investment strategy that takes that into account. Number 13, you can never lose your money in an annuity. You've probably heard this said by somebody trying to sell an annuity, that there's no way you can lose money in an annuity. Now, an annuity is actually a life insurance product or an insurance product where there are some guarantees to the cash value that is in the account that allows you to benefit from some of the guarantees that are in place because of insurance companies, but it is possible to lose your money. First of all, in a variable annuity, there is the account balance and then there's the guaranteed cash payout, and oftentimes they have like a stepped up value and a guarantee of 6% return on the cash value payout and all these kinds of things. But the account balance can actually go down. So let's suppose that you've got this 10-year step up and all this kind of thing, and 5 years you decide to take the money out and transfer to something else. Your account balance could have gone down drastically in that 5-year period, and so you will have lost money in that. And then also, if you have a surrender value or surrender cash surrender charge on your policy and you take that money out prior to the completion of that, then you can lose that. So let's suppose you've got, you know, a couple years into it and you still got 6% left of the surrender charge and they charge you that when you take it out and you put it in, you've only made, you know, 2% per year or something like that, you'll actually end up losing money on that. And so it is possible to lose money on an annuity. It's harder, but it's certainly possible. And then finally with that, you can lose money in real term dollars. Just as I mentioned before, you've got inflation risks and you have to make 6% on your money just to be able to break even in this environment, sometimes even more than that. And so if you're only making 4 or 5% in annuity and inflation's at 6%, you're losing 1 or 2%, whatever it is, in the difference there that would be going to inflation to fight it off. And so in real terms, you can certainly lose money with an annuity. Number 14 is, I need a job with benefits. Sometimes you hear this by people who are unemployed or they're looking to change jobs or something like that, and they're not looking at certain jobs or they're not looking at becoming self-employed or something like that because they say that they need a job with benefits. Well, my question to them is, what kind of benefits do you need? And why is it you think you have to have a company pay for those benefits? The problem is not that you need a job with benefits. Rather, you need to make more money, because if you have more money, you'll be able to buy those benefits in the open market. The more benefits you get, the less your employer can pay you. And so you can sacrifice some of your pay for more benefits, or you can get more pay and then go and shop and get the benefits on your own. Now, I know, I understand there are some challenges sometimes with insurances and not qualifying for insurance and needing groups and things like that. But nonetheless, if you get paid enough, you're willing to go to the open market and purchase those on your own. And so the problem is not so much needing the benefits as it is needing more money. And then number 15, debt can be a good use. Debt can be good if used rightly. The Bible says that debt is a curse. It's unwise. It does not lead to prosperity. And, you know, all you're doing when you use debt is that you are sending money to large corporations, large banks, those kinds of, whoever it is that you owe money to. And they are benefiting from that because they are receiving your money for that. And so debt cannot be good. We need to get out of it as soon as we can. Just like the scriptures say in the gazelle in the hand of the hunter, or the bird in the hand of the fowler, we are to remove ourselves as quickly as we can and get out of debt as soon as possible. Because debt is no good, and I don't know how you can use it rightly. And so avoid it as much as you can. Well, hopefully that has dispelled some of the financial myths that are out there and has been able to give you a little bit more grounding as to the direction you should take with your finances so that you can leave a legacy financially, and that for generations to come, the wisdom that you have imparted financially, the money that you have accumulated as a result of the practice of wisdom has been able to transcend generations and build a legacy of wealth for you and your family. And with that, this has been Steve Donahue with the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. What will you do today to build your legacy? Just